So one of the assignments that we were given at the end of this Majjhima course, which by the way was offered by the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies in Redwood City, which is Gil Fransdahl and his folks, Diana Clark and others that are really offering some wonderful teachings both in person and online. One of the assignments we were given at the end was to take a favorite passage or a favorite discourse, a favorite sutta, and just say what it is about it that strikes you. If you hate it, or if you love it, or if you're attracted to it, or if it confuses you, or whatever it might be. And at the very beginning of the course, I taught here in February about holding the teachings, how to hold the teachings. And last year, I did a day long, actually on this same sutta, and I still really love it. The Majjhima Nikaya number 22, Aluga Dupama Sutta, and it's commonly called the simile of the snake, and that was the teaching that we discussed in terms of holding the teachings. So it starts out with this monk that has these ideas that are way off. They aren't what the Buddha's teaching. And all the monks try to convince him that he's off base and he won't believe him. And so they bring him to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, you know, if a person wants to grab a snake, you don't just pick it up by the tail or it'll turn around and bite you, poisonous snake. So he was actually equating this person's unskillful views with being bitten by a poisonous snake. Pretty serious stuff. Then that's just the first part is about the monk. The second part is about this simile of the snake, how to hold the teachings. You take a forked stick and you pin the head down, and then you grab it by the head, and then it won't harm you. That's the skillful way to hold the teachings. Okay, so that's just one of the similes. So it's called the simile of the snake. It actually has 10 sections, this particular sutta, and tons of other similes. It's not just that one. So it's in the way that the Majjhima is broken up is it's sort of these groups of 10 or so suttas that all kind of cluster around a single subject. So this is called the set on similes, and all of the suttas in this set have various similes in them. So the simile that we're going to spend the most time with tonight is the simile of the raft. And the Buddha taught this simile not as a way of holding the teachings, but the way of letting go in our practice. So let me read in English this simile of the raft. And this is the translation by Tanisara Bhikkhu. Monks, I will teach you the Dhamma compared to a raft, for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of holding on to. Listen and pay close attention, I will speak. As you say, the monks responded to the Blessed One. The Blessed One said, suppose a person were traveling along a path. He or she would see a great expanse of water, with the near shore dubious and risky, the further shore secure and free from risk, but with neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. The thought would occur to them, here is this great expanse of water with the near shore dubious and risky, the further shore secure and free from risk, but with neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. What if I were to gather grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and having bound them together to make a raft, were to cross over to safety on the other shore, in dependence on the raft, making an effort with my hands and feet? Then this person, having gathered grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, having bound them together to make a raft, would cross over to safety on the other shore in dependence on the raft, making an effort with their hands and feet. Having crossed over to the further shore, they might think, how useful this raft has been to me. For it was in dependence on this raft that, making an effort with my hands and feet, I have crossed over to safety on the further shore. Why don't I, having hoisted it on my head or carrying it on my back, go wherever I like? What do you think, monks? And this word bhikkhu, Joseph Goldstein reminds us, means all practitioners. Because he said bhikkhus, it's been translated as monks by this person who's a monk. But in fact, what it meant is the whole sangha. Monks, the nuns, lay men, and the lay women. So when you hear bhikkhus, it means all of us that are practicing and trying to be on the path. So what do you think, bhikkhus? Would the person doing that be doing what should be done with the raft? No. And what should the person do in order to be doing what should be done with the raft? And then I'm going to skip some of the repetition. And so I have crossed over to safety on the further shore. Why don't I, having dragged it on dry land or sinking it in the water, go wherever I like? Sounds like freedom, huh? In the same way, bhikkhus, I have taught the Dhamma compared to a raft for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of holding on to. Understanding the Dhamma as taught compared to a raft, you should let go even of Dhammas, to say nothing of non-Dhammas. We'll unpack that a little bit. So, this sutta has been used, particularly in later traditions of Buddhism, to say that you don't need Buddhism to get to the ultimate purpose of practice, which is awakening freedom. This word Dhamma has three meanings. So Tom Jeff does a nice job here by not translating Dhamma at all. He says, understanding the Dhamma as taught compared to a raft, you should let go even of Dhammas, plural, to say nothing of non-Dhammas. And in Pali, that's a-Dhamma. So we put a in front of the word to mean not like atypical or, you know, atheist. Same way that a, the letter A is used at the beginning of a word to mean the opposite. So understanding the Dhamma as taught compared to a raft is singular. You should let go even of Dhammas as plural, and then to say nothing of a-Dhamma, or things that aren't Dhamma. So there's three meanings for Dhamma. One is just the truth of how things are. I think if you were here last week for Doug's version of the refuges, that's, you know, I take refuge in the truth of the way things are. That's one meaning of Dhamma. Dhamma that's generally shown in English translations with a capital D means the teachings of the Buddha, which, after all, are the truth of the way things are, at least in my experience so far, have been. And then with a little d, Dhamma can mean phenomena. It can mean mind states. The, you know, like the fourth foundation of mindfulness is Dhamma. It's, and then it lists all of the, right, the Four Noble Truths and the Five Hindrances and the Six six Sense Doors and the Seven Factors of Awakening and all that. So those are Dhammas. Those are just phenomena. Those are things. It might be another translation of it. So if we look at this again, what is it that we're really letting go of here? Understanding the Dhamma as taught compared to a raft. So that's probably the truth of the way things are. Or that's the Buddha saying, you know, understanding what I've taught as compared to a raft. You should not let go even of Dhammas. You should let go even of Dhammas. Dhammas, plural. It's pretty clear there that what is implied there is things, phenomena, mind states, things that are changeable. Okay? To say nothing of non-dhammas, things that aren't phenomena. So I find that a little bit more helpful way of looking at the final message of this sutta, but about what is it exactly that we're letting go of. We're letting go of these mind states. We're letting go of perhaps even practices that might have gotten us to the farther shore, to this area that's free of risk, that's a place of freedom, where I can go wherever I like. But it's not necessarily the truth of how things are that we're leaving behind. It's just the day-to-day phenomena. I've also heard people talk about taking refuge in the Dhamma as taking refuge in the truth of the way things are. But also, if you think of the way that we teach meditation in the insight tradition, we're taught to just be aware of whatever arises and passes away, right? Every little mind state, every little thing that occurs, sensations in the body, these are all dhammas. These are all things. These are all mind objects. They're all just things that are happening. And so think about how sweet it would be to take refuge in those dhammas with a small d, to actually be able to take refuge in the passing phenomena of your daily life, and to be able to know that you're safe, to know that you're free in the presence of all of these things that come and go. And as unstable as that might seem, to be safe in that space and to be able to allow them to come and go, and to not be attached to those things as they arise and pass away, and to not cause ourselves suffering when we have a great sitting and we want to recreate that in our next sitting and it's just not there. You know, we're, instead of being blissful and peaceful and calm and collected, we're all of a sudden restless and disturbed and sad memories are coming up or whatever it might be. But to be able to take refuge in the dhammas, in those things that come and go in life, and to be safe there, would be quite a gift. It would be a place of freedom, you know, maybe not complete freedom, but it'd be a place of quite a bit of freedom. So I think if we take this teaching, rather than try to make it too complicated and say, well, you know, the Buddha's teaching has been really helpful to me, so why do I have to let it go to become liberated? I think that gets to be a little bit too much of a koan. You know, it's a little bit too complicated. But if we take it to be, you know, you need to let go even of mind states, pleasant or unpleasant, to get to the other shore, then I find that to be helpful. The other thing that to listen to in this passage is that the person making this journey says, "For it was independence on this raft that, making an effort with my hands and feet, I have crossed over to safety on the further shore." So the idea here is that, yeah, there are these teachings. They're really wonderful. They're very helpful. But we also have to exert a little bit of our own effort. We have to bring our intention. We have to bring our willingness to practice. We have to bring our willingness to see things that maybe we don't like. And we have to get that rear end on the cushion every once in a while. And we have to be making efforts during the day to stay aware and to cultivate that awareness in everyday life. And then all the things that follow from the meditation practice, you know, compassion and right action in the world and so forth. So I think it's useful. Sometimes we get kind of theoretical about things and think that, you know, if we just put in our time, we're going to be free. But this reminder of making effort with our own hands and feet, I think, is really useful. So, unpacking this a little bit more, And by the way, unpacking the word Dhamma and Dhamma with a line over it, that's the plural. That's when there were two A's before and they just combined it in one. Put a line over it, that's the plural, and then Adhamma. That whole teaching came from Gil Fronstall. So in this course, they would give little sutta study guides as you go through. He didn't write one for every sutta, but he wrote a really helpful one for this particular sutta that is available. And he also goes through some of the other sections and things. There's a monk who currently lives in West Virginia or something. His name is Bhante Gunaratna. And that's sort of a mouthful, so people call him Bhante G. There's some very helpful writings. He's the guy that wrote Mindfulness in Plain English. He's a very, very clear writer and very nice. And he's talking about this sutta. And he says, clinging to beliefs without practice can also easily make people religious fanatics who seek refuge in violence to resolve problems. Seek refuge in violence. So, I mean, he's not choosing those words accidentally. You know, this sutta is about using the raft, carrying it across, and then letting it go. Here he's talking about people who seek refuge in violence. Although the Buddha never even implied causing harm to anybody, there are some, even among the Buddhists, who believe that they should protect their country, killing as many as they think necessary in order to protect Buddhism, the religion of peace, harmony, compassion, and loving kindness. Okay. So, you know, I was thinking about this simile of the raft, and we don't use rafts very much anymore. When we do, they're sort of recreational thing. You come floating down the American River on one or whatever. But the raft that they're talking about here was made out of back to the ingredients. Grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and having bound them together to make a raft. So you've got grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and then you're binding them together. And Bhante G says when you do that, you're probably going to do that with some bark or some roots or something. So you've got these five parts of a tree that are making the raft. And what he suggests is that the Buddha is giving a kind of a sub-teaching here about the five khandhas, the five aggregates, the five aggregates of clinging, the five ways that we create a self by holding on to something. They're called the aggregates of clinging because they're the things that we hold on to and in that process create a self. And so those are physical form, the feeling tone of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, the perception, just the ability to see and label things, the formation, mental formations, or just formations, physical formations, mental formations, they're called sankhara. It's a big, huge category of things that includes memories, result of past actions, Any put together experiences that we have, the way that we reframe things, views, opinions, all those are sankhara. And then the last one is consciousness, not in the kind of woo-woo sense of some kind of vague ethereal thing that floats around somewhere in the universe, but consciousness in the Buddhist sense of when you see something, eye consciousness arises, when you hear something, ear consciousness arises, that kind of consciousness. So those five things, if we're not aware in the moment of what's actually happening, we can cling to as being ourself. And so what Bhante G is suggesting is that this raft that we're clinging to can also be seen as the self. And one thing that supports that is that one of the middle sections of the sutta has what Gill calls various views about the self. So there are several verses that talk about the way that we find a standpoint for our views. One of them talks about agitation, which is interesting. I haven't, in other contexts, just from the little bit of study that I've done, I've never seen agitation presented as a way that we create a self. Was that in Rodney's book about the self? Do you recall, Vic?
I don't recall.
I've never heard that. And I read his book and I don't remember that either, but anyway, there's several verses that talk about agitation as a way of creating a self. And then the other two are two of the characteristics of existence, anicca and anatta, impermanence and this idea that there's no permanent, abiding, substantial thingness to anything. So it's right in the center of this sutta. So it's the fourth section is the various views about the self. And it's the pivot point. So one thing that they had us work with in this course is to look at the overall structure kind of academically, not to necessarily sink right down to the practice level, but to stand back a little bit and look at a sutta structurally, like as if you were a literature student. So the structures are, it starts out with Aritta, that's the name of the monk, and his views, which the translation of Bhikkhu Bodhi does is pernicious, his pernicious views, but the word often is translated as evil. And then the second section is the simile of the snake, third section is the simile of the raft. The fourth section is the various views about the self, the standpoint for views, agitation, impermanence, and not self. The fifth section is five similes about the awakened person. In Pali, it's the arahant, but it's somebody that's fully realized. The next section, interestingly enough, is misrepresentation of the Tathagata. The Tathagata being the thus gone is the literal meaning of it, but it's what often in these suttas the Buddha called himself, the Tathagata. So misrepresentation. The second to last section is a bunch of different things that the Buddha advises are not yours and should not be clinged to as I, me, and mine. And then the final section, which Bhikkhu Bodhi calls in this Dhamma, is the way Gill describes it is it's a listing of the kinds of people who have either reached the other shore and let go of the raft or who are holding the raft the right way as it ferries them across. In other words, they're in process. They haven't fully awakened yet, but they've had some level of realization and awakening. So it's an amazing structure. You start out with somebody that's really messed up, bad, and held the teachings wrong. Finish up with those who are liberated. The second section is about the simile of the snake, how to properly hold the teachings. The second to last is how to properly hold anything. Cling to nothing as I, me, and mine. Now, buried within this section called the misrepresentation of the Tathagata is the following line. Both formerly and now, what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering. I can only find one other sutta that has this very famous quote in the Majjhima. I have the Majjhima electronically, I don't have all the other ones electronically. But in the Majjhima, I could only find one other sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 63, where the Buddha says, basically, all that I teach is suffering and the end of suffering. So this is where it is. And it's sort of buried in this section, which is misrepresentation, the way that his teachings are misrepresented. So you've got a teaching at the beginning of how to rightly hold the teaching. Then at the end, he says, this is how my teachings are misrepresented. Now, interestingly enough, that immediately follows his description of the enlightened person, these five similes for the arhat. And that comes right after the various views about the self. That was one of his teachings that, to this day, is not fully understood. I mean, to fully understand that teaching, you have to have some level of awakening. But even at the time, there are these sort of lists of the various ways that people misunderstand that teaching about anatta. So the structure is really interesting to me. Starts out with these pernicious views, gives you two similes for how to hold the teachings rightly and how to use them to get where you're going, you know, the ultimate aspiration for your practice. Then it goes into these various unskillful views about the self, about people that misrepresent the Tathagata, and then it ends up reiterating the instruction about holding to nothing as I, me, and mine, and then finally giving a listing of the various kinds of people that are at various stages of awakening. So just by looking at that structure, you learn something that's way beyond just the actual content of the sutta. The other thing I wanted to just briefly mention here is that when you see a sutta that's this complicated, it probably wasn't said by the Buddha, at least all at once. So the teachings were compiled, they were remembered orally, and then they were compiled several hundred years after the Buddha died in written form. And then they sort of traveled all over the world. You know, one version of them went to Sri Lanka, and a different version went north into China, became Chan and Zen and so forth, became what they call the Agamas, the Chinese canon. Scholars are doing studies now where they compare those agamas that went up to China with the Pali version that went down to Sri Lanka to see maybe what was added later. And it's not uncommon, I don't know the specifics about this sutta, and they haven't been able to do it for the entire canon, what are there, 7,000 suttas or something? But it is not uncommon that the later suttas include teachings that either put down another tradition or defend Buddhism against another tradition. It was probably added by monks and nuns at a later time who were trying to defend their religion. So to me, it's sort of funny that this teaching that we all love about all I teach is suffering and the end of suffering is embedded in that particular section. It just makes me wonder what the compilers were thinking when they put that together. And it was suggested to us in the course that that's another way of reading these, is not literally or not as just practice instructions, but to try to think about what it was that the compilers, the people that gathered all this stuff in one place, were trying to transmit. What kind of wisdom were they trying to transmit at the time that they were compiled, probably 500 years or so after the Buddha died? So I'm not going to try to do that. I mean, I think we can all have our own ideas, but it's just very interesting to me that this teaching about both formerly and now what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering, that sounds to me like something that the Buddha would actually say. Mm-hmm. Now, when you do, the search I did was on cessation of suffering to go through the Majjhima, and Majjhima Nikaya 63 has it as one of the monks was asking, what do you designate? You use a different word. What do you offer? And he said, what I offer is suffering and the end of suffering. It was phrased a little bit differently than this, but it means the same thing. Everywhere else that I was able to find this phrase, it was in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. So, you know, the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha, and the second one is that clinging is the cause of suffering, and the third is the cessation of suffering. So if you do that search, you'll see it again and again and again. Cessation of suffering. So he was teaching it, but he wasn't saying, all I teach is suffering and the end of suffering. So we've got people here defending Buddhism at some level. And I'm thinking it probably wasn't the Buddha himself. Misrepresentation of the Tathagata. There's a whole section. So let's go back to Bhante-ji. Listen to his quote again with a new ears. Clinging to beliefs without practice, in other words, without awareness, can also easily make people religious fanatics who seek refuge in violence to resolve problems. Although the Buddha never even implied causing harm to anybody, there are some, even among the Buddhists, who believe that they should protect their country, killing as many as they think necessary in order to protect Buddhism, the religion of peace, harmony, compassion, and loving kindness. So as I was trying to visualize this teaching about a raft as something to hold on to or let go of, I remembered reading about these refugees that are being driven out of Burma. They're called the Rohingya. They're Muslims. They're an ethnic minority. Myanmar is primarily a Buddhist country. And they have been stripped of a lot of their rights. Some human rights organizations call it an apartheid situation. The government, as their identity cards are expiring, is relabeling them. Instead of calling them Burmese, it's relabeling them as Bengalis, implying that they've all come across as refugees from Pakistan, when in fact these people have been in Burma for thousands of years. So these folks are being driven out of Burma, primarily by Buddhists. And this is just from a web search. This is just an AP news guide to the Rohingya. In the last 3 years, attacks on Rohingya have left 280 people dead and forced 140,000 others into crowded camps just outside Sitwe, the capital of, and the state they're in, I don't know how to pronounce it, R-A-K-H-I-N-E, Rakhine, or I'm not sure how to pronounce that, where they live under abysmal apartheid-like conditions with little or no opportunities for work. So, they try to flee abroad. Most hoping to reach Muslim-majority Malaysia in search of jobs and security. To do that, they crowd small wooden boats nearly every day, an average of 900 people a day. Most of those migrating sell everything they have, land, cattle, gold, to pay human traffickers who typically charge $2,000 per person for passage to Malaysia. Thousands of Rohingya, as well as Bangladeshis, are now believed to be abandoned at sea close to the shores of Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And in fact, just this week, I read a story where the Indonesian Navy came up to one of these little boats and gave them directions, gave them food, water, and directions to Malaysia. About 2,000 have landed on shore, but the three governments have turned away others. An estimated 6,000 are still stranded at sea. So I think that brings up a number of troubling points. One is that holding the teachings unskillfully can cause us to do the opposite of what the theoretical things that we think we're being taught. In this case, driving out Muslims. And, you know, this isn't just a bunch of religious fundamentalist fanatics, lay people. Actually, in some cases, I mean, there are monks that are, you know, opposing this, but actually there are some Buddhist monks that are involved in this activity. It's not just the military or whatever, you know. Just to know that is really troubling. The other thing about that is that in this world where, you know, one would hope there'd be a place of refuge for anyone, there are people that are just out there, you know, they've left this shore of safety. They haven't arrived yet at that shore of freedom. And they're floating around in between. You know, and I mean, you know, you try to equate that to the state of our practice in between picking it up at some point, being inspired to do that, and then the ultimate goal of liberation, and we're in that place in between too, but it seems pretty trivial when you compare that to this real life situation of people who have no home. They're stateless. I mean, literally, even the people that are still in Burma are losing their identity cards that allow them to vote, get an education, do all those things that free people ought to be able to do. So I just thought it was really interesting that, you know, the Buddha in his wisdom, and these little simple similes, you know, one of the rules for kind of what Lee Brazington calls sutta archaeology, one of the clues is that these very simple little similes that just strike right to your heart were probably really said by the Buddha. The other thing is those verses that are often at the end of a sutta, those are probably things that were either said by the Buddha or written down or memorized really, really early to help remember the stories. But it's always amazing to me that these stories, which can seem theoretical or sometimes far-fetched, give them enough time and they'll manifest in the real world in very real ways. So I found that aspect of the simile of the raft very inspiring this time through. So I'd like to acknowledge the Sati Center for this course that they offered, Gil for his really helpful essays, Bhante G for his really skillful interpretation, you know, both of this thing I've read a couple times about religious fanatics when you hold the teachings drawn, and also equating the raft of the five aggregates. That was a really skillful way of looking at it. And at this point, just open it up to questions, comments, anything that people would like to offer or ask.
You know, I love the simile of the raft, but this is the first time as you were reading it, and a couple of things struck me about it. This monk didn't borrow somebody else's raft. You know, it wasn't the Buddha's raft. It wasn't his teacher's raft. He went about and found the grasses and twigs and branches and leaves and made his own raft. And that strikes me as kind of important. Implying, you know, the teaching me that this is a very personal experience, this crossing of the raft. That we put these teachings together ourselves, they're available. But everybody's interpretation and everybody's experience with it is unique and personal. And as a result of his or her own individual effort, you know, the effort of the hands and feet, mm-hmm. or that person's hands and feet, not someone else's. So it's with that individual effort that collecting the various teachings that are helpful to that person in creating his or her own raft, that gets them across. And I find that helpful and actually comforting, because I think each of us has a tendency, you know, I certainly do, to think, well, this is my raft, so it must be inadequate. It isn't the Buddha's raft. Clearly I'm missing some of the proper grasses or twigs.
Great. Thank you.
And the piece of that that I was struck by, it really follows on what he just said, is that it's the understanding inside this existence about those khandhas, exactly what they are in your own experience, that allows one's heart to open so that harm is not done, that's abandoned. And the first time you said that, it was just like one of those proofs in your head where I realized that it's the turning away from the in the body understanding that causes the killing. It's using someone else's using the teachings in the wrong way, just like trying to use the Buddha's teachings, you know, a monk's teachings or any other kind of teachings as a substitute for actually being with whatever that that discomfort or what, you know, what all of the, that mush, how to make a decision, how to understand it. Yeah, that's really, because you see it over and over again. One of the reasons I turned away from Western religion years and years ago was the obviousness of how the people that preached a certain way always wound up doing the things they were preaching against. I mean, it was like it just followed, like day follows night, you know. So it's not surprising to me that Buddhist monks who are who want to believe really badly to the extent that they don't look inside themselves, that they just wind up doing the same stuff. Yeah. So thank you.
Thanks.
So is this where the term stream enterer comes from? The sutta?
Stream enterer.
At the end where they talk about the different levels of, you know, the people that are at various stages of getting across a river. Yeah, one of them is called a stream enterer. So yeah, that's kind of the first level of letting go, is a stream enterer. Yeah.
The other thing that struck me in the simile, I was wondering if we put it up, it's your own tree, branches and leaves and all that, but every time it's repeated, it says with effort, with the effort of your own arms and legs. And that struck me was, this is not a free ride, as it were. Right. This is not just drifting across the stream, this is effort.
That's right. Yeah.
And then when you cross, you've got this thing that you can leave.
Right. You know, it brings to mind the simile that the Dharma punks have incorporated into their practice, which is against the stream. You know, that idea that this practice is against the stream of popular culture, and I mean, sometimes even against the stream of our own evolutionary desire to have it all and consume it all and all of that, you know. But when you think about, you know, using the hands and feet to get across the stream, in a sense, you are fighting that current, right? Mm-hmm. And you're getting across the stream because you're willing at some level to paddle up against the stream.
Yeah, because you mentioned the Rodney Smith book, we did have an affinity group, and we studied that book, and one of the areas that seemed to be difficult for us in there is that, at least the way I was interpreting it, he was saying that effort is a bad thing. And I don't know, you know, I understand about the striving and, you know, gritting the teeth and stuff like that, but it just doesn't make sense to me that some level of effort isn't needed.
Yeah.
Just sort of sit back and, you know, you wish it didn't happen.
Right. So five of us from this community just came off retreat with Steve Armstrong last week. And he's been teaching. His teacher right now is Saida Utejaniya, who's from Burma. And he just finished a retreat at Spirit Rock that I know Laura and maybe others went to. So he translates virya, which is effort. He translates that as perseverance. So rather than, you know, like you say, gritting your teeth and furrowing your brow and bearing down, this kind of effort is just showing up, just persevering, staying with it, trying to maintain your awareness during daily activities, you know, trying to just notice arising and passing away when you're sitting, and that sort of thing. Continuity of awareness. He also teaches that when there is continuity of awareness, then what he calls personal effort starts to decrease, because continuity of effort results in mindfulness. Mindfulness results in samadhi, in collectedness. And once the collectedness of mind is there, then the practice takes up a momentum, has a momentum of its own that just carries it. So actually, as you go forward, you're using less and less personal effort and more relying on the momentum of the practice itself. So, you know, those of you that have been on retreat might notice after 4 or 5 days, once you get past the, you know, the sleep deprivation and all of that, that even if you're eating less and all of that, all of a sudden you have this big burst of energy. Mm-hmm. You know, well, part of it is that you're not diverting your energy to your various electronic devices and, you know, answering your phone and telling the telemarketers no, and all those kind of sapping, draining activities that we, you know, that's just life. That's the way it is. But so that's part of the equation. But the other part of the equation is that you're actually gradually, with persistence, persevering effort, gradually building up the mindfulness and therefore the samadhi. And, you know, the way samadhi is being taught by Stephen, Saida Utejaniya, and others right now is that it's not this sort of clamped down focus on a single object, that it actually is a dynamic awareness that can move as objects change and arise and pass away, and that eventually, you know, much less personal effort is required. So I don't know if that's helpful or if that answers things the way that Rodney raised them in the book, but you know, I think of it as activation energy. You know, like at the beginning of a retreat or beginning of a sitting, you sort of need a certain amount of personal effort to kind of get over that initial hump and get, you know, settle down and all of that. But then after you've been doing it for a while, either within a given sitting or you know, several days into a retreat, it does sort of start to pick up its own momentum and carry the practice forward. Still requires some level of effort to stay aware, but much less personal effort and much more the momentum of the practice.
And another thing I think about is, at least in translations, you see words like restraint, resolve, that kind of thing, which, at least the way I think of it now, is a type of effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tony Bernhardt calls that free won't. question of free will, I don't know, you know, who knows, but we definitely have free won't. We have the ability to say no, I'm not going to have that third piece of chocolate cake, or no, I'm not going to walk by that bar on my way home tonight because I might just walk in, you know, that kind of thing. You have free won't. You can guard your sense doors. You can, yeah.
One of the things I didn't hear you say directly that kind of helps me, the concept of attachment, the sort of literally to hold on to mm-hmm. the raft once you've gotten it across the lake or the river, is to attach to it.
Right.
And of course that gets into the whole, it's my raft, and I'm going to keep it with me and all of that. But I was kind of having, I was trying to connect what you were saying about the sutta with the what's happening to the people in Burma or Myanmar, and that whole idea of kind of attachment seems to me to be relevant in that, you know, the situation of being a Buddhist in that culture who's helping to perhaps prevent people of a different faith from being able to be saved, you know, suggest kind of getting really so attached to whether it's your creature comforts or your safety within a, you know, the political security or the cultural security, whatever that may be, but really losing touch with the fundamental basis of the whole thing, the whole compassion and love and caring and relief of suffering, if you will. It just seems like that kind of helped me to kind of connect the sutta to the situation, the political situation there. But I also had a question, and you didn't address the using the two-pronged fork to catch the snake as the way to catch the teaching, which implies that the teachings are dangerous. Which I can see how they could be dangerous in a certain sense, but you didn't say anything about that. I mean, you know, I sort of think, okay, these teachings are good, and the more people who can be exposed to them, the better.
Yeah.
But maybe.
Well, the full quote is that a person was in need of a snake, so they needed a snake for whatever reason. So they, if held wrongly.
Right.
The teachings can be dangerous, as we see in this situation in Burma. They're being held wrongly. They're being used against another faith to drive them out. But the use of the stick is the you pin the head down, you grab it by the head, and then it's held rightly.
Okay.
And so the teachings held rightly are not poisonous.
Okay.
The person had a use of the snake. You know, the fact that the snake's poisonous was irrelevant. He doesn't use the snake for something else. But he was able to hold it rightly and pick it up safely by using the pronged stick rather than just grab a poisonous snake by the tail. Being held wrongly, it's going to turn around and bite you and be poisonous. And so holding the teachings wrongly is deadly. You know, in the case of this monk that he was trying to reprimand, deadly because these poisonous beliefs that he was holding were kind of affecting the Sangha negatively. But in the case of the refugee situation with the Rohingya, it's quite literally deadly.
And so it's that notion, extension of that notion that any belief you can turn into a reason to twist or distort the underlying intention.
If it's held wrongly.
If you hold it wrongly or you become
That's right.
rigid about it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, I'm really new to the whole practice, though. What would be a belief held wrongly or unskillfully? Like
well, in this case, he tried to make the case that he didn't have to check any of his sensual desires. He's a monk. They're supposed to do that. You know, there's precepts against just letting your sensual desires run rampant. And so he was saying, well, no, that's not the case. And the Buddha said, no, you're holding that teaching wrongly in that particular case. Now, you know, I mean, in our case, there could be teachings that we maybe misunderstand or we try to see them through a Western lens, you know. I mean, these are offered by people 2,500 years ago in India, and sometimes when we try to see that through our current lens, it just sort of distorts them and can be confusing, you know, like some of the teachings on karma or you know, talking about past lives or future lives or something like that. It can get very confusing. And we're holding wrongly because that's not our cultural background. So, yeah, it's just something to be aware of, that our own cultural biases and our own personal biases can sometimes get in the way of seeing them accurately. Yeah.
When you were talking about the boat people, and the confusion in Myanmar, I was thinking of that Thich Nhat Hanh poem where, you know, I am the refugee who was raped on the boat, and I am the pirate who raped the refugee, and I just somehow the hit of the fear behind the attachment, that when we get so attached, there's such terror behind it.
Yeah. Fear of the unknown or fear of the other.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What are the options for putting boundaries, so to speak, on those folks in the case of Buddhism to bring back a sensibility to what's going on, or any religion as far as that goes? What's going on? What is there an opportunity apart from more violence what's the answer? is there one, or do we have to be satisfied with, well, that's the way it is?
No. We don't have to be satisfied with that's the way it is. My answer to your specific question is I don't know. Because I don't have the cultural background to understand the history behind this situation. But, I mean, there are human rights organizations both inside and outside of Burma that are doing what they can to address this situation. And actually, it's even the Buddhists within that particular state, that state has been discriminated a lot, against a lot. So it's a very complex situation. And it's not really our purpose here tonight to try to solve a political situation. You know, I was really just using that as a way of letting this teaching about the rap kind of sink into the heart. But, you know, it's neither my job nor my expertise to try to sort out the politics and so forth, what the long-range solutions are. But there are a number of human rights organizations that are working on this, including the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
Well, I guess I'm thinking more of the teachings themselves. If a group is bound by the teachings, but they go outside of that,
mm-hmm.
What within the system, is there anything in the system that brings people, I don't guess I know what I'm saying, but... you know, I just think it's not in, you look at Christianity over the centuries, you know, what was done, and currently where the issues with the Muslims now, and it's rampant.
Right. Well, I mean, if we look at, like, Thich Nhat Hanh's activities during the Vietnam War, you know, he certainly didn't say it's okay. I mean, he put himself right in the middle of that. And there have been... You know, you look at the Tibet situation, there are monks and nuns that are standing up, you know, quite courageously in that situation to address it. So, you know, the larger question of does Buddhism just tell us, oh, that's just the way it is, and, you know, that's their karma and it's going to work out? No. No, I mean, in this case, you know, compassion compels action of some kind. And, you know, maybe for us that's writing a letter to, you know, to senator or to the president. Or the UN High Commissioner for Refugees or something. But within that culture, you know, I would hope that some courageous Buddhist monks could speak to the people and say just what you're saying, that, hey, this isn't actually our practice. We need to be more consistent with our teachings. Whether that will happen in this specific situation or not, I really can't say.
Like indifference and numbness is not the same thing as equanimity.
Right. That's right.
I mean, we have to accept that these things are going on, but doesn't say that we don't do skillful actions to try to alter that.
To address injustice, yeah, that's right. Okay, one final question here, or comment? Yeah.
My feel is just to say you have compassion, empathy, and you want peace, but you don't show it. or you don't put forth the action to show it is meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, or we would have peace. A lot of leaders speak to have peace, but they're not having peace.
Mm-hmm.
It's wars. They're not having peace with each other. They have negotiations, but there's no resolution. So I feel that the people that what they're speaking, they're actually putting, like you said, right effort and following behind that effort and accomplishing, showing some accomplishment from what they're saying.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, well, thank you for your attention. Just close briefly with recognition that this world is filled with suffering at all different levels, whether that's the discontent of person of privilege or the misery of a refugee on an open ocean being refused a safe shore to land on. But by coming together in this way and practicing together and discussing the Dhamma, we generate a force of goodness that is so badly needed in this world full of suffering and cruelty. So dedicate whatever positive energy we may have generated here tonight to end suffering for all beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free. Thank you for your practice.